Well, it's good to be here again. Thank you for your welcome. We've just had a reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 19 to 23. You see in your sheet in front of you that the title of this talk is To the Ends of the Earth. Our focus this morning is on mission. I just have two other verses I want to refer to at the beginning. One is in Acts, don't turn to these, Acts chapter 15, verse 26. Paul and Barnabas, men who risked their lives for the sake of the gospel. And the other one in Romans 15:20, where Paul says, I have sought to preach the gospel where Christ is not known, because I don't want to build on another person's foundation. We are living today in a period of tremendous Christian growth. Christianity is expanding, the church is growing at a greater rate than ever. Ever since apostolic times, we have never seen the amount of church growth as we are seeing in the last 20 or 30 years. But let us not deceive ourselves, let us not get complacent over this. There are still, somewhere in the region, they tell me, of 2.5 billion people that are still unreached. Now the Bible talks about the nations, and as you probably know, the word nations doesn't necessarily mean the political entity that we might think of today. It is an ethnic group, a tribal group. The word ethnic comes from the Greek word that is translated nations, and so there are all these people groups, they are called today, all over the place, many of them still unreached. Now the national church in many countries of the world is self-functioning, and it's functioning a lot better than some of our churches in the Western world. The way it was 100 years ago is no longer the way it is now. We don't have to be thinking of missionary activity in a sort of colonial pattern. The churches in those countries where the gospel has gone, those churches are up and running. And many of them are outreaching, they're growing and they're vibrant, and there's an awful lot that we could learn from them. But what about the unreached? That's what I'm thinking of. What about those that have not yet been reached? So we want to touch on that also this morning. I think whether it's us or whether it's these people in the other countries that I just referred to, the church, the Christians, the verse before us is always, of course, Acts chapter 1, verse 8, where Jesus said, you'll receive power after the Holy Spirit has come upon you and you'll be my witnesses. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And so you start where you are, you move out to the next circle, ever-widening circles as you move out. We can understand that geographically, or we can understand it culturally. And just for a little bit of a difference this morning, I want to think of it culturally. That is, you start with people of your own group, and then you move through a transition to people who maybe share something of your characteristics, maybe your language, maybe your religion, maybe your culture. And then you move out again to people who are totally different in language and culture and religion. Now there are all sorts of grades in those areas. I've just mentioned three, the start, the middle and the end. But of course you could divide the place into as many categories as you like. What I'm going to do this morning is just go very quickly through a number of people in the New Testament and see what we can learn from them, and I hope be challenged on the way through. We're going to start with those who were among their own, then those who cautiously at first moved out to people who looked and behaved and spoke a bit differently, and then how they moved out more radically into totally unreached areas. We're going to start with the church in Jerusalem, and James, the brother of Jesus, was the main man in the church. There were other church leaders, of course, who were prominent, but all of them seem to have had a fairly conservative view. Now, I'm not saying that James was as legalistic and as nationalistic in a Jewish sense as some of his fellow leaders were. Some of those became quite a problem. But when the church started in Jerusalem, they saw tremendous growth. They went out, and those who received the word were baptized, and they were added on the first day, it says here, 3,000 souls. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and so on. It goes out in the next few verses to say that every day they were attending the temple. They were breaking bread together. They were praising God. They had favor with all the people. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved. But all of these people are coming out of the Jewish context. And I suspect that they saw many of these early Christians as devout Jews. They went to the temple every day. They prayed like mad and they went to Jewish functions. They were a very fired up lot of Jewish Christians. But as time goes on, there were many people there who were just nominal Christians. They seem to have the same sort of problem as we have of nominalism. And when you come many years later into chapter 15 of Acts, we learn that there are some there in the church in Jerusalem who say you cannot be saved unless you are circumcised according to the law of Moses. And when a person says that, I'm starting to think to myself that that person himself doesn't know what it is to be saved. You come to the story further on, many years further on, when Paul comes to Jerusalem at the end of his last missionary journey. He is met by representatives of the Jerusalem church, and they're on his side, so to speak. They don't want him to get into trouble with some of these conservatives, but they say, "You see, brother, there are thousands among the Jews of those who have believed who are still zealous for the law." Now, these are Jews who have believed, so apparently they're in the church, but they are still zealous for the law. And they were a problem. And that church in Jerusalem was a problem church. In many ways, the church in Jerusalem is a parallel to the churches in Australia. Most of the activity is still within the church. Most of the activity is still keeping the Christians happy and conforming to the Christian ideals. A lot of legalism, a lot of deadness. And if anybody dares do something different, as Paul did, then he is in hot water. It's not only Australia. You find this sort of thing in country after country around the world. Not only in the Western world, but in the non-Western world also, you find similar attitudes, because this is the comfortable way to go. Stick with your own. Don't upset things. Just let us keep the system going, and that is the limit of people's vision. But we move on to the next person, who is Philip. And Philip made a clean break with those Jewish conservatives. He went to Samaria. And Samaria was a place that was inhabited by people who were part Jewish and part something else, and their religion was mixed as well. And he went down to the coastal regions. It says he went down to Caesarea. He started to preach down there. Then one day he met a man from Ethiopia who was returning from Jerusalem. Now, this man was an African. Scattered around North Africa and Western Asia, some of these areas, there were people who went to the Jewish synagogues, because there were Jews scattered in those areas as a result of things that happened over the previous numbers of centuries. Some of these people were attracted to the Jewish religion, and they became believers in God. They went to the Jewish festivals. They were not yet Christians, but they were called God-fearers or worshippers of God. The Ethiopian was one. He had just been to Jerusalem. He was on his way home. Philip met him, and Philip explained to him the Christian gospel, and said the one of whom this Old Testament writer was speaking is in fact Jesus. He explains Jesus Christ, and this man now becomes a believer in Jesus Christ. And he changes from being simply a God-fearer to being a Christ believer. He now becomes a Christian. Philip goes on his way rejoicing. The Ethiopian goes on his way rejoicing. But we can see now things are starting to change. Philip moves down to Caesarea. And many, many years later we meet him. He's still there. I'm not sure if he has been other places in the meantime, but he is still ministering there 20 years later in that region along the Mediterranean coast. But at least now we've got out of the ghetto, so to speak. We've started to mix with a few other people and take the gospel to those who are not exactly the same as us. We come now to Peter and John. Now, John is one of those that we often think of as the gentle disciple, the disciple whom Jesus loved. He was possibly the youngest in the group. We tend to think of him as chubby-cheeked. He wouldn't say boo to a goose. Nice, gentle character was John. I'm not so sure. In fact, I'm certain he wasn't. Because Jesus gave John and his brother James the nickname Sons of Thunder. They were fiery characters. They blew up. John was not all sugar and spice and all things nice at times. And we see that on one occasion when they were going through a village of Samaria and the Samaritan people didn't welcome them because Jesus and his friends were on their way to Jerusalem. The Samaritans didn't like the Jews, and so they gave these people a rough time. John and James, they came to Jesus and they said, "Hey, should we call down fire from heaven and burn these characters up?" Nothing terribly gentle and loving about that. That was a very rough way to handle people you don't like. Jesus had to calm them down, these two sons of thunder. "Hey," he says, "we don't do that sort of thing." But that shows the type of attitude he had even towards Samaritans who were not ethnically and religiously and socially the same as the Jews. But John started to change. In the early church, we have just referred to the church starting in Jerusalem, and then the activity of Philip. And if you read on in that same section that we referred to concerning Philip, you would find that other people believed as a result of the preaching of Philip and other people. So much so that the heavies in Jerusalem, the leaders of the church in Jerusalem, thought, what is going on up there in Samaria? What is Philip up to? So they sent some representatives of the church leadership to go to Samaria to suss things out, just to see what was happening. And the two they chose were John and Peter. And when John and Peter came to Samaria, credit where credit's due, they recognized that this was the work of the Spirit of God. And they praised God for what they saw and supported Philip in this ministry to a different sort of group. But the point of the story, for our purposes this morning, is that on their way back to Jerusalem, they themselves preached the gospel in many villages of the Samaritans. Now, that's a change, because only a few years earlier, maybe less than 12 months earlier for all I know, but certainly within the last year or two, John was wanting to call down fire from heaven and burn up these Samaritans, but now he wants to see them trusting in Jesus Christ. Of course, he should have been even more radical, got out of Jerusalem entirely and gone to the ends of the earth as Jesus had told the apostles. But things happen slowly with some of us. We don't always act as promptly as we should. But as I say, credit where credit is due, at least John is now starting to broaden his field. And what about Peter, the man that went to Samaria with him to check out these Samaritans? Well, you find that Peter soon is down on the Mediterranean coast in a place called Joppa. And then he gets a message from God that he's to go to Caesarea to meet a Roman. A Roman. This is a man who has come from Italy, and he is a God-fearer too, like the Ethiopian man. He's come to some knowledge of God, he wants to worship God, but he's not yet a believer in Jesus. And so God sends Peter to him. You're familiar with the story? But Peter had to be changed first. Then he had this vision of this great sheet, and in it were all creepy, crawly things that God said, okay, Peter, you can eat these. And Peter said, not me, I'm a Jew, I don't eat that sort of rubbish. I mean, I'm respectable, cleaned up, I keep all the food rules and regulations. That's unclean stuff, and I'm not going to eat it. And God said, don't you call unclean something that I have cleansed. And it was a message for Peter that if he had no fear about eating unclean food, he had no fear about going into the home of an unclean person and eating whatever was served up to him there, because they considered the Gentiles unclean. They weren't, of course, conformists to all the Jewish rules and regulations. God was preparing Peter for the house of Cornelius. And so Peter went. And once again, we must give credit for how this man changed. He said to Cornelius, I have perceived that God shows no partiality. I've come a long way from my Jewish upbringing. In every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him. That's why he sent me to you, because you are a God-fearer. You're a worshipper of God, but you're not yet a Christian. And I've come to tell you about the one that God sent into this world to save sinners, Jesus Christ. And so he made the gospel known to him. The result was that Cornelius and his friends believed, when you get to the end of that story. Peter and those who were with him were amazed. They were amazed, it says, that the gift of the Holy Spirit was poured out even on the Gentiles. What next? Goodness me. We thought that only the Jews were the chosen people of God who were going to get the Holy Spirit. But here God is pouring it out even upon Europeans of all people. And so he says, can anybody forbid water for baptizing these people so that they can do what we have done? They can be baptized and they can receive the Holy Spirit just as we have received. He should have actually been moving on to more radical fields after this. But I'm afraid that the old traditions die hard with some of us. We make one step forward and we say, hey, well, we've gone beyond what we were before, but let's not be too rash here. And so we tend to control ourselves. We're basically very conservative at heart, most Christians. We don't want to do things that are too wild or woolly. We find that Peter still had a few things in the background there, because a number of years later he was in Antioch and some people came from Jerusalem and they started to force these new Christians to conform to the Jewish food laws and other Jewish laws. And Peter succumbed to the pressure. He started to pull away from this group of Syrians and other Turkish people and people from North Africa and people from Cyprus, this mixture of non-Jewish people. He started to pull away from them and cuddle up towards his Jewish buddies who'd come from Jerusalem. And Paul was very outspoken. You know, this is in Galatians chapter 2. And he said, I rebuked him in front of everybody. He said, hey, what are you doing? He said, you shouldn't be going back to what's been left behind. God saves all people of every nation on the same basis. The grace of God extends to them and they respond in faith. He shows no partiality. Peter responded and he rejoined the Gentiles. And to give these men due credit, we look later in their lives and we find that both of them are way out in the Gentile areas, up in Turkey of all places. They've left Jerusalem behind well and truly now, and we find that Peter is up in Turkey on the shores of the Black Sea, those areas around there. And John is in western Turkey, over in Ephesus and areas there. And at the end of his long life, he's actually imprisoned in an island off the coast from Ephesus, awaiting his execution. And so, there we have it. Moving out from the inner circle, stage by stage. And some of us, it takes us a long time to change because we're safe in our Christian community. Only a few years ago, I heard a man well in his 80s say something I never thought I'd heard him say, because he was a very conservative person in the church and he was an obstacle to other things that wanted to be done. If it had never been done before, then he wasn't going to let it be done a first time, that sort of person. And in a conversation with him, I heard him say, he said, you know, the trouble with us was we were too conservative. And I thought, am I hearing this from this man? But it's a bit late when you're well up in your 80s. The damage has been done and there's not a lot that this man could do. There wasn't a lot of time left for him to do other things. And so we do move rather slowly at times, and I hope that we can learn some of these lessons. Peter and John moved slowly, but in the end of their lives, they were fulfilling very fruitful ministries way out somewhere else. Let's come to Paul. Now, he was the one that was quite different. He was the revolutionary. He was the controversialist. He went out from Antioch, of all places. He was a Jew, but the church that he became associated with was in Antioch, which was in Syria, and which today is in Turkey. And this church was composed of all sorts of people, as I've just referred to. It was different from Jerusalem. It wasn't Jerusalem that became the center from which the church expanded. Jerusalem fossilized largely. It just settled down and looked after itself and became a cozy club for people who were like-minded in their beliefs. But it was Antioch that saw the challenge. And it says we have to reach out from here into the unreached world, into the western extremities of Asia, and of course, as God directed, it went across even into Europe. And that's the way it is today, actually. It's the people who are comfortable in their Christianity that are not going anywhere, like the Jerusalem church. Most of the western countries are like the Jerusalem church. Settle down, keep the system going, don't really do anything too rash or radical, and a bit suspicious of people who don't look, act, behave, or speak exactly the way they do. But the thrust in world mission today is coming from the non-European world. It's coming from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America, from these places that had been evangelized out of Europe, but now Europe has fossilized, and these other places, they're the ones that are now picking up the football and running with it, if I can use that expression. They're the ones that are motivated and outreaching and are now providing the thrust in world mission. And so it was in the first century. It was the church in Antioch, this church of converts, converted through people who'd been kicked out of Jerusalem and gone somewhere else. Then they started to speak to other people besides Jews, and it was these people who now saw the vision, and they sent out Paul and Barnabas into the regions beyond. Paul was a frontier missionary. He risked his life, as we've just said. He was ostracized, as we've seen. When he came back to Jerusalem, everybody in Jerusalem, or nearly everybody, it seemed, was suspicious of him. What's this character been up to out there hobnobbing with all the non-Jewish people, telling them that they can be God's people without having to conform to Jewish laws? They don't have to go to the temple. They don't have to keep Moses' law. And they were pretty upset over this controversialist among them, who of course was Paul. We read that section earlier in Corinthians chapter 9. He said, you don't have to become a Jew first in order to become a Christian. In fact, he said, I'll go the other way. I actually am free, he says, but I've made myself a slave to others. To the Jew, I became like a Jew in order to win the Jews. to those who are under the law, I became like one of them to win them. To those outside the law, I became like one of them to win them. It's not that I'm lawless, he says, I'm under the law of Christ. But I want to win those who are outside, and so I become all things to them. Unfortunately, with many of us, we expect everybody to become all things to us. They've got to come into our church, sit in our seats, pray our prayers, sing our songs, go through our routines. And if they conform long enough, they might hear the gospel. But that's not the way it should be. We don't expect people to come on our territory so that we can evangelize them on our territory. We are to go out onto their territory where we can evangelize them on their territory. We've got to become all things to them, not expect them to become all things to us. And once again, we have this problem. It's worse in the West, but it happens everywhere. Because as soon as people become Christians, they find a new life. They find that Christianity administers some good things to them. They no longer fight and squabble and waste their money with gambling and drink and things like this. And so they find that being a respectable middle-class citizen is not a bad way to go. And so they thank Christianity for it. They then settle down to become just ordinary, non-adventurous Christians. And instead of being self-denying and going out, denying themselves, taking up their cross, they settle into a fairly cozy type of Christianity. And they expect everybody to come their way. They tut-tut and criticize if things are not as they should be, but they themselves don't really stir themselves. And so that's why the world has not been getting evangelized. That's why the unreached are still unreached, even in our own country. Paul had a strategy. He went into the population centers, the main population centers along the Roman roads. He preached the gospel, and there he tried to plant a church. When he got the church planted and it was functioning, he then moved on to the next center, and it was left to that church now to propagate the gospel in the regions round about. It was good to have a strategy, but the strategy wouldn't work unless those churches themselves were fired up. And so it's necessary to become true disciples, not just nominal Christians, not just adhering to the gospel and a few requirements of Christian life and practice, but to constantly be spurred on and to realize that God has called us not to a religious club, but to a center from which we reach out to the lost. And there are plenty of people in our country that have never heard the gospel. And there are plenty of people all around the world that have never heard it. In fact, as I mentioned before, about 2,500,000 that still might be classified as unreached. The people in our country are not in that classification. They're not classified as unreached because they are within reach of the gospel. There are churches and there are Christians all over the place. So it is not, in that sense, an area where you find the unreached peoples as you find them in other countries, people who have never heard about God or Jesus Christ. We say now, leave it to the nationals in the countries, but of course many of those countries don't have national churches. Now, in many countries of Africa and Asia and Latin America, the church is vigorous and strong. They are evangelizing their own people, and some of them are sending missionaries out into other countries. It's great to see the missionary force coming out of the non-European world. But many of the countries I'm just thinking of here, some of those in the Islamic world, places like Libya or Saudi Arabia or Yemen, these sorts of places, they have virtually no national Christians. And if they are, then they're in hiding, perhaps. Or you can count them on your fingers, there are so few of them. What are we going to do about these countries? We have to find creative ways of getting in. And one of the things that impresses me as I travel around some of these countries of Africa, especially Nigeria, is to see how people in Ghana and Nigeria and some of these places are looking for creative ways of getting into those countries. Study Arabic. Get yourself onto a university campus where, at some risk to yourself, risking your life for the sake of the gospel, as Paul and Barnabas did, at great risk, they're trying to take the gospel to people who haven't heard it. These people that I'm speaking of in some of these non-European countries, they are good at evangelizing their own. Like that woman of Samaria, Jesus met her at the well. She went and told the people of her village, and she brought them to Jesus. And they said, ah, now we've heard it from the man himself, and we know that what you told us is true. It's great to see the enthusiasm. You don't have to enthuse some of the people in these countries about evangelism, because they are more enthusiastic than most of us have ever been. But we've got to get beyond that, to discipling the converts in those countries, and then getting beyond the boundaries of those countries to evangelize those who've never heard. Perhaps the Samaritans, in a modern equivalent of the Samaritans, those who have some ethnic or cultural or religious commonality, maybe only 50%, but at least there's a contact point to get out into those regions. Paul says to the Thessalonians, from you sounded out the word into all the regions round about. I don't have to boast about you because everybody knows what you've been doing. We need that sort of outreach within our own group, within our own country, reaching those who haven't heard. But what about those who are in these unreachable countries? The ends of the earth. That's the title of my talk. And so I just want to leave this challenge with us and realize that although many of these people from Africa and Asia have more convenient access than we have, the reason being, of course, that we're white, and we've got a legacy of ill will in many of these countries because of colonial overlordship and because of current economic imperialism. The West has got a lot of problems in acceptability, and if we go looking as if we've come from the West, most of us do if we're European stock, then it's difficult to get acceptance. Whereas people from Asia and Africa don't have that sort of baggage with them that we have. They don't have those negatives that are barriers that have to be overcome. It's more open in many ways. The possibilities are greater for these people, and I'm pleased to tell you that many of these people are in fact going in and accepting the challenge. But do not use that as an excuse for you and me to sit back and say, oh well, they're doing it now, we don't have to do it. It's just as much your responsibility and mine as it is those other people. And we have to think of how we can get involved. But if we can't go ourselves, how we can support those who are going. Whichever way it is, let us not make excuses, but look for the opportunities that are presenting themselves. And to take some of the lessons today, I'm sure that all of us here in this building will fit into one of those categories. Either we're conservative like James and these fellow elders, or we're just making a bit of a start and we're getting into the other people like Philip, or maybe we're learning a few things as we get older like Peter and John and starting to change, or maybe we're quite radical and different like Paul. But whichever way it is, let us challenge ourselves, what can we do to help in this wonderful task of world evangelization?